This area has a natural and long association with racing. Racing was used to market the products of the oil companies around here. When you think of names like Quaker State, Pennzoil, and Kendall up there in Bradford, and even today, the Brad Penn brand coming out of American Refining Group, this is racing country. We may not know it, but we are. And so it's natural for us to be having this conversation today. Now, Bob, I'm really curious. How did you get started out there at the Speedway? I know it goes back to the 50s. And would you share that beginning story with our audience?
Actually, my first visit to Tri-City Speedway was 1978. It was a time when I was drag racing. I was very active in drag racing in Ohio. And I had stopped over, and someone had talked me into going to this dirt race. Never been to one, and I went to this dirt race and watched the race. And I thought to myself, I said, I could do this. And I said to a couple of the people with me, I said, yeah, I could do this. I could drive one of them. Yeah. So I ventured down to the pits, and I talked to a couple people, and I actually convinced the guy to let me take his car out the following week. So I came out, and I drove a fairly good race. They was kind of shocked in hot laps how much I picked up on it. Then the following week, I actually started the race, and when I started the race, I started on the front row and ended up flipping the car end over end down the back stretch. And so my racing career in a car at Tri-City became very limited.
Uh-huh.
So they found out my background in racing and asked me would I be interested in starting out as an official as a little bit more safer.
Uh-huh. I have to admit, I'm looking at you, and I'm looking at your eyes. You have racer eyes. Did anybody ever tell you that?
Mm-hmm.
You look at those guys, NASCAR, that sort of thing. They have that that even set look, and everything is really right where it's supposed to be. And as you're talking to me, I'm watching your eyes, and I'm saying, this guy looks like he can race a car. So I believe you were born to do it. Too bad your career didn't go any longer than it actually did. Let's go back to the beginning of Tri-City. You know quite a bit about it, and could you share that with us?
I can. The first races at Tri-City was in 1954, and they were very limited. Merwin Tarr and his brother-in-law, John Hedges, they had come up with the dream to build a speedway in Benango County. So they hauled all the rock and all the stuff that needed to be in to build the bleachers. And a unique place in the 50s of that racetrack was they found if they put the bleachers close to the ground and didn't build them up like other speedways were doing, they got a substantial insurance break.
Oh.
So they hauled in all the rock, put a quarter-mile racetrack in, and it ended up being one of the most famous racetracks on the East Coast during the late 50s and the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the famous drivers started coming in. And they, it was a very fast track. There have been drivers that I've interviewed that have said the likes of Henry Jacoby, Gus Linder, and some of the famous names that we know in this area, that said when they went through the turns at the quarter-mile bull ring that it would be so steep that they couldn't see the front stretch. So if there was an accident on the front stretch, then they couldn't see it and they'd be involved in it because they was hitting speeds of 120 mile an hour then.
Mm. Mm.
So that's the beginning of Tri-City, but they had to change it due to the danger of the speedway.
Did you actually lower the slope of the turns?
They actually redesigned the whole speedway in 1963.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
In 1962, there was a fatality there, and it was due to the high-speed banking. And so Merwin Tarr closed the speedway down in 1963 and reconfigured the whole racetrack, reconfigured the pits, left the bleachers to get that discount, and he made it a half-mile racetrack and reopened in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the famous drivers started showing up.
Who were some of those famous guys?
So the first real famous guy that everyone would know was Gus Linder.
Mm-hmm. I know that name.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Gus Linder, he was one of the first drivers to take an oil sponsorship to Daytona. He needed to know where to get money to take a Studebaker down to Daytona. And this actually happened in the early 60s. And he got a hold of George Stroop, and a local historian here in Old City, and George had connections in Quaker State. So they gave George the okay to give him a sponsorship. He gave him a check for $100,
mm-hmm.
and gave him 10 cases of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually the first one, and we have some pictures that were available showing the Quaker State car on Daytona, and that was before Richard Petty's famous STP. So Quaker State did not know at the time the what they were getting into down there, but they knew that they had, that was their first step into NASCAR.
Ah, great. Did Gus win that race?
Gus did not win that race, but he did finish.
Yes, he did finish. That's important. Yeah.
Yes, that was his first time there.
Good.
So he was the first famous to really go to one of the major speedways and do something for the local area.
Did he stay with Quaker State throughout his racing career, or did they flip back and forth between other sponsors?
He did. He carried the Quaker State banner, and Quaker State, most of the oil companies that you name, found out if they put the sticker on the car, most generally they leave it on and they get that advertising at the other speedways where they run. So they picked up on that pretty easy, that they was pretty liberal with giving out their stickers. But what they did up at Tri-City in the 60s was everybody that raced, if they had a Quaker State sticker on their car, they got a bonus cash, and the sprint cars got $25 plus a case of oil.
Oh.
But they had to have that sticker on their car.
Yeah.
And it was very common for the Quaker State officials from the old city area to come to the speedway and see these stickers on these cars. They couldn't believe that these guys were so dedicated to putting that sticker on their car. And they said when it came across at the start of the green flag, it looked like a sea of Quaker State because everyone had these all over their car.
Well, the Gus was one of them. Can you recall some of the other fellows that we should remember that should be honored? Some of the other great names that raced out there at Tri-City?
Yes, Henry Jacoby was a very famous, probably Gus Linder has taken all the fame, but Henry Jacoby was one of the more famous drivers from the Franklin area. Now Henry chose to stay home, when I say stay home, Neil, I'm saying that he stayed home in the particular areas of the racetracks in these areas. There's five or six within an hour's distance that we could race on. And Henry chose to stay home, but when there was a big race, he seemed to show up at these big races over in Indiana. He raced over at the Winchester Speedway. He was the 1963 Williams Grove National Open, which is one of the most famous races in Pennsylvania and one of the most recognized races still today. It's still going on. He won that, beating out Gordon Johncock.
Yeah, name I.
In 1963.
Right. But what kind of cars were they racing? Various classes, various types, and maybe the general audience won't appreciate what all they were, but what were they? Sprint cars, championship cars, stock cars? What were they racing at the time?
In the early 60s, they started out with what they called a ducktail coupe. And it was the old modified junkers that we used to see or still see in the old footage that you see on, that remember back then.
Yeah.
Well, they changed in the early 60s, and they came out with a fuel-injected car. And that fuel-injected car became a sprint car. And that actually happened at Tri-City. Tri-City was known to be a super-modified track. There was three guys, Lou Blaney and Andy Phillips, and I believe Dick Cotterman was in it, a local driver in Old City here, came back with the fuel-injected cars. And that was the first fuel-injected cars to hit the speedway anywhere. And it was called the Three White Mice. The cars looked the same, if you just different numbers.
Yeah.
And they were very fast. They lapped the whole field, and they said, now we've got a problem. So they come out the next year with what they called the sprint car. So it went from a ducktail coupe to a sprint car, and that's where sprint cars were launched, and the history of that started right here.
Is that right? I was not aware of that. I'm a sprint car fan. Late coming to it, but nonetheless a fan. And I didn't know it actually began here. That's something. The workup on the chassis and that sort of thing in these cars today is incredible. You can't even begin to associate them with the normal automobile anymore, how they're put together. But that's quite a field. Were you ever involved in that? Were you ever involved in the actual setup of those cars or anything like that?
In my later years, I have been. I've set up many race cars, been a crew chief for local driver Bob Family. Between us, we have, I believe we talked of 132 feature wins, and we have 13 track championships. And that's a pretty stellar record.
Oh, yeah.
For a local driver, we tried to hit anywhere we could race. There was nights we raced four or five nights a week. So, yeah, I was actually helping build the cars. It started out, as we'll talk, I hope later, about Mike Case in his chassis shop out here. Is where it all started in my career as far as working on race cars and getting people
involved. Is he the fellow that had the shop out there in Cranberry?
That's correct.
Tell us, we'll go to that now, because he's kind of legendary, yet not much is really known about him, at least among those of us who are into racing all the time. Why don't you kind of expand upon that now, Bob, so we don't forget? He is kind of a legend, wouldn't you say? And there's a great deal of mystique associated with that shop.
Yeah, he is, and very well put. He's an innovator that they're still using in drag racing today. Mike's career was always drag racing, national drag racing, nothing on a local level. Mike started out in California, lived in California. He raced cars out there. Moved back here due to some Quaker State sponsorship that was involved. Quaker State was one of his sole sponsors when he raced the Speed Racer car. That was his first what they call a funny car.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved back to this area, opened a little garage up beside his house out on Bradensburg Road. And the reason he did that was to keep the secrets away from the other drivers.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew where these cars were being built at. No one was allowed, with exception of the employees, to go into the shop and see what the new designs were. Because he was the first one to introduce the big wing on the back of the dragster. He was the first one to bring a 300-inch rail car, and that's what they're running today. They made a rule that the car started out at about 230 inches, and they started to expand a little bit. The more they expanded, the faster they got.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, no one will ever do a 300-inch car, and the very next year, Mike came out with a 300-inch car with a big back wing.
Mm-hmm.
The car went very fast and broke the world record at that point.
Yeah.
That car was built out here at...
right out here on Bradensburg Road. Is that the section from Big Egypt over to... 257, is that where he had his shop? Somewhere in there. We won't get into that any more than unless you want to.
No, it's at the end of Big Egypt where it all started.
Is that where, is that right?
Right across from Big Egypt, yeah.
Is that right? What do you know? I drive by there all the time. No, it adds meaning to it. Now, what happened? Obviously everybody grows old and things of this nature, and I take it he retired from the business. Am I correct on that? At least they're not doing that anymore out there. I haven't seen that kind of activity. Or are they? Am I wrong?
No, they are not, Neil. What has happened is he built that dragster for Kenny Bernstein, and his car was driven by Darrell Armstrong, who's very well known in the NHRA races.
Circus, yeah.
Yes. Kenny Bernstein went to what they call a funny car, or a flopper, as the old story goes. Mm-hmm. With the new cars, they were called floppers. When they come out, they look so weird, they call them a funny car. Well, Mike built Kenny Bernstein's cars, and he was the secrets that he was holding out there is he was designing a car that they could put a computer on, and that's how Kenny Bernstein started setting world records. With because they would see him go to the front of the car and do something, and nobody knew at the time what he was doing. He was actually turning the computer on, and that would tell what the car was doing going down a quarter mile. They'd take the information back to the trailer, and they would diagnose where the car was slacking at, adjust it, and make it go faster. And so Mike was an innovator in that. Now, it was Bernstein's idea to come in and do that, but Mike designed the car for him to do that.
The secrecy. I've heard this.
Secrecy.
The secrecy around this. This was, there was the Manhattan Project, of course, for the atomic bomb.
Sure.
And then something equally secret were these car building projects right out here on Bradensburg Road. We should expand on that a little bit more. People around here don't quite realize the impact those men were having in racing, and in just basically automobile engineering, if you think about it. The impact that would have long term. And it was all occurring out there away from the center of racing, particularly drag racing, and it was out there. And then they would ship them out. What'd they do? They'd do this in the middle of the night in a rig that nobody could even begin to identify? Certainly they had to have spies around here.
They did.
Okay, they did, yes.
They did, and Mike picked up on that. And if you can remember years back, if you were born and raised in the All City area, that a lot of times the Budweiser caravan would be down at the Quaker State building, or either the Indy car with the Quaker State car and the Brent Bodine car, they would all be down there.
Mm-hmm.
that they would be putting on shows, and they would do that as a community service, with no charge to the community. In the meantime, they was picking up cars at Mike's house, the Budweiser team was. Budweiser and Quaker State were the two primary sponsors on all of Bernstein's cars. And that was due to Mike knowing the executives down there to get that close for him. So that's why it came to this area. And they would pick these chassis up, and whatever Mike had designed, they would take it to Maple Grove Speedway. They would be down there testing why they was up here, why they had the rig and stuff up here. So no one knew what they was doing while they was out testing these cars.
Right.
And then they would come back and do a community service project. That's why they came to Quaker State to do a community service for their major sponsor and left, and no one knew he was picking up race cars the whole time.
Well, that's the way it really is in the real world.
Yes.
Russ is a very competitive guy. And I've been told, well, they are your friend, and they're not necessarily your friend. It's one of those, there's a camaraderie amongst those men, typically men. I suppose there's some women involved in this. But there's a camaraderie, yet there's that edge that they all have. And it's quite a world to live in. You've lived in it. You've been part of it. I understand you're going to, let's just jump ahead a little bit. We can come back. Of course, there's so much more to talk about. But you're going down to Daytona, in another week or so?
That's correct, yes.
It's that time of year. It's become part of the American culture to anticipate these things at the end of January, first part of February. It's always been around here. I'm kind of getting carried away about my own love for racing. But there are other companies involved. Now, you may not be as familiar with the non-Quaker State ones, but Pennzoil, of course, had its own program, very competitive program. They were more into Indy, I think, at least initially. Am I correct on that? And then they made the transfer to NASCAR.
Yes, you are correct. They were not too supportive of NASCAR or the NHRA. They stayed specifically with the kart organization and Formula One. That was their baby. When Quaker State became successful, and Kenny Bernstein actually put a Quaker State NASCAR team together, that's what the Quaker State officials asked him. We need to have a NASCAR team in green that could be recognized out there. Well, it wasn't long after that that Pennzoil seen the success of this in the television coverage, that there was a Pennzoil car that Michael Waltrip came out in. It actually started out with Johnny Benson for the first 2 years. Johnny didn't do too well, then Michael Waltrip got in it and was fairly successful with it. So that was Pennzoil's journey into to NASCAR and moving away from kart. And they also found the same in NHRA. They started, when they seen the success of NHRA, they seen that they didn't have a Pennzoil representative there. And so they had a gentleman by the name of Jerry Ekman that was driving a pro stock car. And that car was found to be illegal. And so he was banned from NHRA. He still is today.
Right?
And they retired the Pennzoil car.
Is that right? That's how it all came to an end in drag.
It did. It was. They was more into the drag racing than they were the NASCAR. But NASCAR was not as a successful organization in the, say, 60s and in the early 70s. In fact, we didn't even see any television coverage until 1979 of any NASCAR events. That was the first one that was televised as the Daytona 500 in 79.
I remember seeing it in the 70s, like you say, Wild World of Sports would cover.
That's right.
The Cale Yarborough races.
Yes.
And it was considered in those days, the culture was a little different than it is today. Now they're very sophisticated, they're gentlemen, that kind of thing. In those days, they were brawlers. They were brawlers off the track, on the track, and you knew it. Very different kind of world. Maybe it was tougher getting sponsors. It wasn't considered necessarily family entertainment then, which it is today. You're right. Very different. Love it, though. Just love it. We have other oil companies in the region. Maybe they weren't as involved in NASCAR. They may have been involved in the drag racing thing. They were involved in the road races. For example, Kendall sponsored the one up there in New York, Watkins Glen. Long time. There's a tower up there. I don't know if it's still there. I've never been to Watkins Glen. Maybe you have. But there's a tower up there called the old Kendall Tower where they push things. And there's, of course, back into it today. times have changed. Where do you see racing going in the next 10 years? The audience is different, what have you. Where do you see it nationally, and then we'll get back to this area, Tri-City, that sort of thing.
One of the concerns we're having, if you're talking of today and the next 10 years, one of the concerns we're having right now is with the big three in the economy that we're in today, that with the bailout that has taken place, they have eliminated their motorsports departments, most of them. Yeah. So parts have been very hard to get a hold of this year. As soon as this bailout started, we've been really down on getting able to get parts, motor parts, or what have you. A lot of the NASCAR shops are saving some of the local racers, so they'll save the local racers in this area by getting their engines and stuff out of the racing divisions of these particular NASCAR divisions that have General Motors yeah. as their sponsor. As far as the future in racing, last year, due to the economy, NASCAR was down 23%. This year, they don't know. That's just an up-in-the-air thing. But what we have found is we've been through this before. This is nothing new, and that we'll get through it again, and we will be racing. There'll be a full field of cars down at Daytona this year. There'll be a full field of cars out at the racetrack at Tri-City this year. It seems like no matter the economy, the racers seem to find the money somewhere to fulfill their hobby.
Well, let's hope.
That's all.
I suspect even if they have to go back to the old county fair tracks, there will be something. Let's go back somewhat. Do you remember the days of Herb Scott, for example?
I do.
Maybe your dad more so than you, but I grew up on Herb Scott. They raced, seemed like, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, no matter what. It was always in the paper. A lot of those old tracks are gone. But nonetheless, that was part of the culture. Around here, Tri-City wasn't the only track.
No.
There were other ones. There was one over there originally in Knox. Am I correct on that?
Yes, there was. One that's going to open up again this year. It's Knox Speedway, and it is a quarter mile, could be a 3/8 mile dirt track that's reopening. There was also the Pine Grove Speedway in the 50s. And a lot of people don't know about that. There was a lot of drivers raced over there that raced over at Tri-City. There was also a racetrack in Bully Hill in Franklin. And that was that was in the early 60s when Tri-City shut down to redo their track. They opened a speedway. Joe Sali opened the speedway. He was a local junk dealer. And it was up at Glen Drive Speedway is what it was called. And the top 10 drivers that were in that, of course, were the Jacobis, the Linders, and the Phillipses, and the names we just suggested. But they that racetrack did not last long after Tri-City reopened. Mm-hmm. It was simply because of the facility was not up to grade, and the drivers, it wasn't really safe. And mm-hmm. the drivers knew they'd have a safer facility at Tri-City, so they went back there. So that's a few, and that's what and that's just in our local area.
Yeah.
And just like you said, there were so many days in the week that you had to race. So there were guys that were racing Wednesday nights, Thursday nights, Friday nights, Saturdays, and Sundays.
Kind of down towards your area, the track I'm thinking of is the one that's outside of Butler on the way over to Route 28.
Lernerville. Yes.
I go by there quite a bit. I haven't been to Lernerville, never gone to a race there, but that still looks like it's a very active track. Am I correct on that?
That is correct, and Kendall is one of the sponsors down there.
Yes. In fact, they have a shop or a distributor's place right across the way, mm-hmm. and they're pushing their Brad Penn,
yep.
their green racing line, that sort of thing. So I have noticed that. One of these days I'm going to have to get down on that track. So, well, it's still very active here in this general area. What about beyond, you would expect it to be big on the West Coast still and down there in the South in those states, but what about the rest of the country? How's racing doing?
Part of a organization called the RPM Workshop out of Daytona, Florida, I'll be at this year, and I'll know more about that. It's where all the local promoters get together and talk about how their seasons went mm-hmm. and how they expect their seasons to go. We're finding that we are seeing very little. With what's going on in NASCAR, we're seeing that people are coming back to their roots and not traveling as much. Most people that go to 3 NASCAR events are coming back to their local routes and only going to 1 NASCAR event and spending the rest of the summer at home. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for a successful year at the local speedways. We originally thought that running the Saturday night races, and NASCAR is running a lot of Saturday night races. That's a new thing because they ran Sunday afternoon. We thought that was going to really hurt our speedways, but it hasn't. It's been actually made it more popular, picking up a new fan base, and you had shared there were some lady drivers. We've had several that are still active campaigning today in mm-hmm. in most of our racetracks. Mm-hmm. And some have actually kind of, at Tri-City, for instance, there was a girl that raced out there. She had been traveling around with the All-Star Circuit of Champions, and her name's Sarah Fisher. Mm-hmm. And she actually races the IRL circuit today mm-hmm. and is very successful in it. But she had won a feature race out here, raced out here regularly.
Oh, wonderful.
And, she really put it to them. She was a good racer.
I have to tell my wife this. She's a fan. And it's just another reason for me to drag her out to Tri-City. We kind of sometimes... that's an alternative. That's something you want to do around here when you get a chance. And it's loud. It's exciting. There's no question. But yeah, that's a place for women nowadays. It's a very appropriate place for them and families just in general. I think the crowds are pretty well behaved. Most of the men realize there's families around, that sort of thing. They try to watch themselves.
Sure.
It's not at all inappropriate place for a family to be. And I kind of am with you, Bob. I think racing's coming back to its roots. I like to see it happen. NASCAR gets very expensive. It got to the point, you can expand upon this, please. I had friends who went to a number of races. Within shooting distance, very few went to Talladega, too far away. Mm-hmm. But the ones down there in Virginia and West Virginia, North Carolina, you could get to them. They all got very expensive.
Mm-hmm. One of the things they're dealing with now is they talk of price gouging in the gas industry. We found that there's been price gouging in the hotel industry. If you go to a racetrack, you're buying a room that would cost you $100 after the races are over the following week. You can get that room for $100, but if you rent that room for race week, it's a 7-day minimum with anywhere from $200 to $350 per night mm-hmm. for that room. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that was putting people losing interest in it. Mm-hmm. Then when you got to the speedway, you was paying $100 per person to get in. Mm-hmm. You was paying $50 or $60 for your child to get in. Mm-hmm. So when you're done, you've got a $1,000 bill before you know it. And you've got to pick and choose where you go. And that's what happened in NASCAR, and it's coming back to bite them. We've talked about this in depth with many of the racetrack promoters. Humpy Wheeler, you know, down in Charlotte. I was in Charlotte in November, and that's one of the things that he was concerned about. And they have lowered their prices. This is the first year that I'm aware of in NASCAR history that they've brought the prices. They're selling half-price seats at Daytona this year. Ordinarily at Daytona in February, you couldn't get a seat. You couldn't get a motel room. There's motel rooms available, and there's sections that they're considering not opening.
Well, in a way, that's good news.
It is.
Because, of course, the racing public, it's all of us. And we have to be able to attend. And no matter how much your enthusiasm, you reach a point where if it gets just too expensive, you say no. So that's good news as far as I'm concerned. I hope the industry sees it that way. I really do. But let's go back. We'll come back. We'll refocus on the area. Let's go back, if we can, mm-hmm. to the extent you and I know something here. Racing in the very early days was connected to this area. The Miller family. Now, I know there's a lot of myth out there about what they did, but we do know there's a Miller Trophy right here in Oil City, right down the street in the Benango Museum. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit what you know about the Miller Trophy and the involvement of that family in early racing?
Well, being born and raised in Franklin and delivering papers to the Miller house, I got to
close
know
back.
A little bit about that. And,
yeah.
I learned that this Miller Trophy was a trophy that the drivers would win, and you would keep that trophy for a year. And if you won the following year, you got to keep the trophy. If you didn't, you had to give it to the driver and kept it. So it was kind of like the holy grail of trophies that went around to anybody that won that year, that season. So that's where the Miller Trophies actually started from, and it was found in a warehouse that was about to be tore down in Florida. And thanks to the connections that George Stroop had in that area, he got that recovered and brought back to its home in Oil City. So mm-hmm. it is a very special trophy for our area.
Yeah.
The Miller family, as far as their racing, they was into Fiats. And he had actually went to France and learned about the Fiats, the Renaults, the Fiats. And they was quite the top-of-the-line race cars you could buy. And he seen them and had ordered some of these Fiats to bring back to the United States to race. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they was racing in Indianapolis and different places like that. And he brought four or five, I'm not sure the number, but it was four or five, it was up there, cars that he had trained back to this area, and he got the cars up so they could be pass inspection to go race, and he hired out the Chevrolet brothers, and they came over and drove his cars for a short time and was very successful in them, and of course we know how successful they were.
Later on.
Yes,
manufacturers. Right. That's quite a history, really.
It is.
I would hope that we'd get some film of that trophy and make it a part of this program so we can share with the audiences that are going to be watching this what that trophy looks like. It's quite an impressive trophy. I know I, for one, would have been very proud to win it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yes.
All right. Here we are. It's of course now we're in the 21st century. You're traveling again this upcoming week. Where do you see you're going to be involved in racing over the next decade or two of your life?
Well, to give you a fair answer of that, I'm probably going to be involved in a traveling series. I too stayed home and raised my families and worked this racetrack the best I could to get it so we could bring people in. And this track is self-sufficient now. It's doing very well. Very proud of the owners that have it now, and they've done a wonderful job. It was kind of my baby. In the mid-80s, I actually overseen building that racetrack from the ground up. It was a vacant lot due to a fire that occurred in 1981. Electrical fire had taken the buildings out. And a person by the name of Bob Myersberg showed interest in the Speedway. And he asked me if he would buy the Speedway if I would oversee bringing it back to its glamour days. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was young and didn't know what I was getting into, and I thought that was the best thing to do for the Speedway, so I did that and ended up the first year putting 36,000 miles on my truck, bringing people back into the Speedway. But we took our time, and it took us 2 years to bring that Speedway back. We put all new bleachers, brand new buildings in 1984 is when we started that, mm-hmm. and brought that Speedway back to its glory days. And anybody you called in any part of this country knew of that Speedway, and we're so glad to hear it come back. And I'm satisfied that that is in good hands, and it's going to be here for many years to come. So I'd like to take my chances at going out into a traveling series. There's two or three traveling open wheel sprint car series that are out there, the World of Outlaws, the All-Star Circuit of Champions Sprints, and they're two of the series that are close to my heart. I raced with them throughout the years with the Bob and I raced the car and was fairly successful. These guys are the best in the country, Steve Kenzer and Sammy Swindoll and all them guys. So I look forward to maybe traveling with them for a while.
Oh, great.
See how that works.
You'll be spending company with Hall of Famers.
Hall of Famers.
True Hall of Famers. I'm familiar with the names. Of course, Steve Kenzer and Sammy Swindoll at the very top of the game. Boy, what a life. You're going to enjoy the next 10 years from the way I see it. That's wonderful. For the benefit of the audience that they don't live around here. Many people will be watching this who just plain don't live where you and I are talking about. I just want to point out to them that whether you're at the track or not, when Tri-City's having an event, all you have to be is out there on 417 and Don and Franklin and coming up Route A or down Route A, and it's just wall-to-wall people. A lot of them with their trailers and their cars and that sort of thing. And you know there's a big race somewhere. If you don't know where Tri-City is, you just don't quite know where it is. But it's an event around here. It packs Franklin for a while, and it's just something to see. I don't know if you're in any way involved with it, but that McDonald's down there in Franklin, it's race themed, and really it's really very 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 well done. You can see it's had a major impact in this area, and it's eminently successful. Now, the only thing that's a problem about it is occasionally there's rainouts,
sure,
and we all get disappointed with the rainouts, but that happens anywhere. So
let me share with the McDonald's. I was part of overseeing that office.
Really?
Yeah.
Those some of your cars in the cases.
Some of my cars in the cases, uh-huh. And the helmets up there. One is the one that there's some unique stuff in there. Bob Felmley had broke his neck at Tri-City in the 90s, and his helmet down there is the one he broke his neck in.
Oh.
And he's back racing, but the company was going to do a NASCAR theme, and we took them out to Tri-City and said, well, why can't you do this? And they put it together as a local business, local people. They're going to know who these people are because everything is NASCAR.
Yeah.
So we went ahead and put that in there, and they made a statement to us during the ceremonies we had down there that it was such a success that they never they've always went NASCAR, and they said they're going to relook at their stores now and see putting more local businesses in their stores, not so much maybe racing, but something else that's
right
in the area.
Huh.
So that's how that started. But I can't get back to Tri-City in my years there because of the Penzo involvement at the end, and that's what's just been awesome.
Yeah.
They have really put it on the map. And when I say that, Quaker State had its time, where it helped the drivers out. We needed to come up with a way. We found from our RPM workshops that not everybody comes to see specifically the racers. They come. That's a bonus show that you need to entertain them and put on a show for them, something to go on in between the races.
Mm-hmm.
And we need exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And with the amount of budgets that we were dealing with, we couldn't reach exposure. So 1997... I got a hold of a gentleman that was born and raised in Old City, was an executive with Pennzoil named Bill Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Bill about the Speedway, and he remembered as a child going to the Speedway. And I told him, we have it up and running. Everything is first class all the way. It's known to be the Indianapolis of dirt track racing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came out and looked at the Speedway, and he wanted to know what we needed. What do we have to get Pennzoil's involvement in it? And I said, well, of course, you know, it depends on how many dollars you want to spend. We can paint it yellow or we can keep it red. And so he said, what do you need the most? And I said, what we need the most is exposure. So what he shared with us is we started out at a $50,000 package per year and then ended up settling for a $47,000 package per year, which included an electronic scoreboard, not in the $47,000 package, but in addition, a big electronic scoreboard that you could advertise on. It was actually the first scoreboard in this area to come in, and we could do that. It was the first racetrack to have that.
Mm-hmm.
You put all the numbers up there. You could put the advertisers in different panels up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bought that, and they went under a four-year contract. But what really helped launch that racetrack was Pennzoil's advertising department, because they tagged us on all their commercials in our area, in this whole region.
Mm-hmm.
And that exposed us to many more people, and that's when it became a success. And they're still involved in it today. They're still working at it. They use that facility to do business deals.
Yeah.
We would do things where they would bring new clients out there that were looking at the area, and they would bring them out for a night of racing. We'd get a phone call, and just whether it be Quaker State or Pennzoil or who, or Kendall even, they had brought a couple people out to look at the Speedway. And they show them, you know, what the facility's like and what the drivers are like. And we always had a bus we took down and toured them and showed them, made sure they had a good time, took them in the lounge. And they were so impressed with it that what Pennzoil started doing in the area was giving tickets out to employers, people that had their customers.
Yes.
And so we would give them a bulk amount of tickets. And then on four Pennzoil nights throughout the year, they would actually put in a dollar off and Pennzoil picked that up, and then they would also have the hot dog night, and Pennzoil would split the cost of the hot dog and a Coke. And so they was actually, they wanted to reach back to the people of the area, and they also wanted to reach the racer. So we gave the racers the oil and a minimum bonus cash like they did with Quaker State, and then the rest went to the fans and the TV.
Outstanding.
So yeah, they was very supportive of that Speedway, and in my eyes, it made it the success it is today. We couldn't have done that without them.
Well, that makes sense, and that's really a pleasure to hear how these things not only do succeed, but how they actually happen. Bob, the world you're in is you pick up input from all sectors of the country. You run into all kinds of folks. We were having a kind of a funny little chat before we got started here about, for example, Bill Elliott. Those who don't know NASCAR, Bill Elliott was famous for not only winning, he's a Budweiser car, early Budweiser car. He was also famous. He won the Winston Cup in the early days. But also, you couldn't understand what he said. This is where I'm going with this. Western North Carolina and I guess parts of Georgia up there in the hills where a lot of those shops started for the national cars. Those guys are a different world, different breed. Here you are. You go back and forth in that world. I haven't picked up any influence of their idioms and their slang, if you will. Mm-hmm. But how do you get back and forth? How do you understand all these people? This is kind of a silly question, I'll admit it. But how do you understand? How do you talk to each other?
You got to be aware, Neil. We talk funny to them.
Okay.
To start with.
Not like we're talking.
They can't understand us. Uh-huh. So sometimes the communications are a little bit a little bit difficult. Yeah. But most generally, it used to be a Southern sport. But most of the Midwest has moved to Charlotte area. And the people we're racing with and dealing with down there, most of them are from the Northern Tier. There are many East Coast drivers, and that's what happened. It used to be a Southern sport. And they had a tough time with the guys coming down there. And they didn't want them. They just didn't. This is our sport. This is a Southern sport. It's below the Mason-Dixon line. We don't need you up here. Mm-hmm. And when they found out how talented they were, and they found out that we were bringing oil money with us and sponsorships, then it became a welcoming mat. Mm-hmm. So it is hard. There's times when I come home. If I've been gone for a long period of time, I will come home, and my wife will say I have a twang when I'm talking to her or something like that that I didn't know I picked up.
I found with my racing friends from the South that it's always interested me how we really became friends over racing. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And now, rather than think of guys from the South and the guys from the Northern Tier like you're talking about, I always associate, truthfully, Sprint and the tracks with up here in the North, Pennsylvania and then Indiana and places like that. And then their kind of stock car on dirt tracks again until they got good tracks. That's a Southern thing. It's all kind of broken down. We're all the same kinds of fellows and gals. And racers are racers wherever you go now. It's become
That's
a
right.
national culture, and it's really a pleasure to be a part of, wouldn't you say?
It is. It really is. Some of the drivers that we didn't talk about in the current years of Tri-City that are very successful today is Dave Blaney, that raced at Tri-City.
Yeah.
Jeff Gordon. Jeff Gordon raced at Tri-City in 1985. Right. First year we had reopened the track. There was a call from Indiana that there was a guy coming up from California. They called him a California kid then. What they didn't tell me, though, is he was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, our insurance requirements are you have to have a valid driver's license to race or be 16 or older. So I didn't know how to handle that. I called our insurance companies. There's three insurance companies in the United States that will insure racetracks, and K&K is who we chose. K&K does solely racing. There's only one that did solely racing. Mm-hmm. I called K&K in Indianapolis, and I said, I have a kid here. They said, name Gordon. I said, yes. And they said, he wants to race. And I said, yeah, and he's 14 years old. What do I do? And they said, if you sign, type up a waiver and have him sign that waiver saying that he will not hold the racetrack or us liable, you can let him race. And he was very upset. That he couldn't race because when he was in California, he wasn't allowed to race at all. So that's why he had come here to race in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So he signed the waiver, gladly signed the waiver, went out and was very successful. But I could find out where he was racing out by other promoters calling me and saying, hey, what'd you do with the Gordon kit? How'd you handle the Gordon kit? You know, and not knowing how successful he was going to become.
Yes.
You know, it was kind of comical, Neil. I went down to Atlanta, and he was doing an autograph session about 4 or 5 years into NASCAR. And I stopped over, waited in line to see him, and stopped over, and I said, do you remember me? And he said, you're the guy from Tri-City. Uh-huh. Do you remember that? He said, you signed my first waiver.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, the Olson family has lost that waiver, and I'd like to find it. They're looking for it now, but it's still circulating somewhere around here.
Yeah.
They said they would try to find it for me, but he remembered, and of course, Dave Blaney. You know, Dave Blaney's running the circuit now, and he's been doing very well in the last 8 or 10 years. Dave was, he grew up on that racetrack out there. His father was a multi-time champion.
Mm-hmm.
His brother played for Los Angeles Lakers, left the Los Angeles Lakers to go sprint car racing. He's still he's a world champion sprint car racer today. He grew up out at this racetrack. So there's a lot of history
to that track.
To that track of people that are successful in NASCAR and IRL today. Mm-hmm. With the Sarah Fisher.
Yeah.
Larry Dixon in 1964, I believe it was. Larry Dixon was second to Gus Linder in a 100-lap race, not knowing at the time he was going to be a famous Indy racer.
Yeah.
He was very successful.
That's wonderful. Do you guys have a Hall of Fame out there?
We do.
You do?
We do. We just started that.
Yeah, you must have. Because I haven't been there in quite some time, I have to tell you that. But yeah, that's what you do need. That it's an obvious thing that all those great personalities have passed through that track, and it is a piece of racing history. It's not just racing history; it's the region's history. It's Western. It's called Pennsylvania history,
mm-hmm.
And of course, it's also associated with the industry that that kind of has made this region go: the oil industry and the great old names. You cannot separate them. They are all part of one big story. And you know that story better than anybody. And it's been, for me, a real pleasure to be talking about this thing. We're getting to the point where we're going to start winding this down. Is there anything you would like to share with the Pennsylvania audience, or even for that matter, a national audience about racing here in Pennsylvania, of course, Tri-City, something that they may find years from now for those who are still watching the series. What did that guy say? What did Reverend Bob Graham say about racing in Pennsylvania?
Well, there's a driver I didn't bring up. He's still living today, and he's very unique. He is the only living driver that has driven on the sand at Ormond Beach and driven on the Super Speedway. He's, I believe, 88 today, this year. But he's still active. I brought him to the Oil Heritage Festival to sign autographs and put a display up for him. And here I had to call. He was in Japan welding a ship at 88 years old. He's a great welder. But he would take cars from this area. He'd buy them at a gross. He bought one car. His first car that he ran on the beach down there was a 58 Mercury.
Uh-huh.
And he bought that car at a dealership,
yeah.
Drove the car down there, and they took it over to Smokey Unique's, changed the wheels, and put the decals on it, and took it out and raced it on the beach. He drove the car back, and they peeled the stuff off. It was paint then. They took all that off, and took everything that they had modified the car with, and then put it back on the lot for sale.
Is that right?
Yeah. But he is the only living driver, and one of the famous things he did at Tri-City is he raced sprint cars out there for several years after his career ended in NASCAR.
Uh-huh.
And he took a wild flip in turn three, and his arms come out of the cockpit, and he was actually hanging out of the top of the cockpit. It was very common with them drivers, and he even had a roll cage.
Yeah.
And he broke both of his arms.
Okay.
And it was at that time we decided that something needed to be done in the sport to keep the arms in the car because of the G-forces when they're flipping. And we always said they put roll cages in them, they will flip. That's going to happen. Well, this picture that we had shot and sent down to Bill Simpson Racing, designed from that picture, from that accident at Tri-City, designed the shoulder harnesses that they're using now. You've heard of the Hans device, the newest thing.
Yes.
Well, now drivers are wearing, in the last 15 years, they've been wearing these restraints on their arms that are tied right into their harness, and they just click them together, and it keeps their arms in the car. Now, it's uncomfortable until you get used to it, but when you flip now, your arms will stay in the car. So we've had very limited arm breaks since then, but that all started from Tri-City with his arms hanging out the window. And I might add, that Neil, that he was 57 years old when he took that flip.
Is that right? Yeah. Who was this again?
This was Dick Bailey out of Grove City.
Dick Bailey out of Grove City.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bob, it's been a pleasure. I do hope we get a chance here, possibly, to get a shot of some of your collection. Mm-hmm. I don't know quite how we'll be able to work that out, but it's extraordinary in itself. And maybe we'll be able to get together here and do a few of those, and maybe you'll be able to make some comments, and we can share that with people. But I think it's about time we bring our conversation to an end. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You are as knowledgeable as folks claimed. You came highly recommended by your friends. You must understand that.
I appreciate that.
You really did. You're the guy, as far as they're concerned. And really, we thank you for coming up here and taking the time today to do this. This has not been a good day to drive any kind of distance. You're in Wexford, is that correct?
No, actually, I'm down in Franklin.
Down in Franklin. We even come up from Franklin. Come on. It's just one of those days, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this. It's really, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it.
Good
it was
luck
my honor.
I hope you enjoy Daytona.
Oh, I think I will.
Thank you.
Okay.
Might be a little short on time, but having said
that... Well, it's a little short. I was thinking.
He has these... Do you need some visuals? He has some outstanding visuals.
I need some tons of visuals, and... Do you have access to any of the old racing footage that we can get the rights to?
What kind of footage are you looking for?
Well, anything from Tri-City, but also anything from any of the dirt tracks around here. Any of the stuff from way back in the 50s and 60s from the old film days that have been converted to video. That we can intersperse throughout and maybe add 5-8 minutes just throughout, just to show the transition. And then we're going to need lots of visuals. Were you talking about the McDonald's downtown?
In Franklin,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll need permission to get into McDonald's and shoot that.
They'll let you do that. You could ask.
Yeah, Jeff Rogers has had the part.
There's a minute there.
Yeah.
If you do it right.
Well, I'm while you're talking, though, but I'm thinking the race footage and stuff, to have the noise, and we can even manufacture the noise if it's silent. If we can have some extra race footage, that would expand the time a little bit.
And then the grad student also did the taping of your exhibit at Venango Museum.
Oh, did they? Great.
Yeah, they
we did that before it got taken down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
I'm not sure what he did.
Yeah, I've not seen it.
But I know the cases were still up and the...
Were they able to shoot through the glass? I was concerned when I heard
what they did.
I think they opened the glass. You can flip them things down.
I think because Betsy was there. I think she did open things, and he got the uniforms.
And he could get in there and actually get it without any of that.
So that was done back in, November?
Mm-hmm. I hope it's good.
Yeah, I do too.
There.
So
I'd have to message one and get everything to you.
Okay.
But we were sure.
Well, he lives here.
I can get you a lot of stuff. I mean, there's just unbelievable what's out there. I can get you. Can you use stills as well? I mean, I have pictures of Jeff Gordon when he was 14. Mm-hmm. Out there. I have anything I've talked about.
Yeah.
I have.
Yeah. Anything that you absolutely have the rights to, that we can, because what we want to eventually do is turn this into a 13-week series and then shop it to PBS. And so PBS is really strict. We have to have signed, written rights to everything we use.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could get that, that'd be fantastic. And it would really, your conversation was very good, but it's so visual that we're going to, this one especially, is going to be filled with visuals. I mean, we're going to see you guys talking, but it's going to be a lot less than we did in some of the other ones because you have such a visual topic.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about, and it's really good to be talking about, you're talking about Sprint Series cars and things like that, to see what one looks like, back in the day and now, to and see what the Tri-City Motorway looks like, and maybe even go shoot some footage now of a race, when racing starts again.
Sure.
Because we're going to be doing these up through May. So, I'd love to go to the raceway and shoot some footage.
Get the noise. You got to get the noise.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You don't talk racing without the noise of the track.
Well, see, what I would do is I would get the noise, and then I'd use it kind of in different places throughout this.
Would you prefer to go to, there's two different ways you could do that. Is a local race would be the local racers, obviously, or there's the World Wildlife that come to Lernerville that put on an incredible show in sprint cars.
Oh, I'd love to get, be able to get.
Well, I can get you that. I can get you authorized to do that if you want to do that, and you
definitely
can film right off the top.
Yeah, because if we can do that with HD, oh my Lord, it would be great.
The first show's in May.
First part of May?
Yeah. We're also having Kendra up here. I've got him scheduled to come up here in June with his rig and his car to set down at the museum.
So I'm definitely going to be here in June. I won't be around probably in the middle of May. I'll be around the first week of May. When is Lernerville?
I'll have to check their schedule, but it's right around there.
Okay.
It's right around the first week or two of May.
Yeah, because we're done May 1st, and I usually try to get the hell out of Dodge.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, it's usually a long semester. I need about 2 weeks just to decompress. But, yeah, that would be fantastic because then we could put, and it would be neat if we had some older footage. You know, if you know anybody that has some film footage that they've converted to video, because I can take, even if it's on VHS, that's fine. We'll letterbox it and make it look like it belongs. And everybody knows that, you know, that's what you get when you do a documentary. You get all kinds of footage from all kinds of different sources.
Bob, what about that tape that George put together?
Pioneer tape?
Yeah.
That's right. A pioneer of four or five of the drivers that are here.
Right.
That we talked about. There is Gus Linder in that.
Right.
Bill Wheeling. There's everyone we spoke of is in that.
Does George really have rights to use that, though?
Yeah, it's his. He filmed it. He used it. He's okay.
Does he have the original footage?
He should have. I would think the only I don't know what format it's in. That would be a problem.
Well, if we find out what format it is, I can probably find the financial support.
I want to warn you with George, though. Watch. If you get involved with him personally, I think I would check things with Bob and me.
Oh, I'll definitely go through you
because
guys.
Because he has a way of, you just can't count on it. It's just George's nature.
Yeah, you have to stay on it. The stuff that I talked about, I personally have visuals of all the stuff. Sarah Fisher winning the races and doing all that stuff. I have access to that because I had the Speedway then, so it is mine.
Okay.
Anything that I give you, I have tons of stuff I can give you that, and obviously I'll get a return, correct?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Then I'll be glad to to do that.
Yeah. Okay. What we'll do is we'll go through and really make a good transcript of the tape and then think about all the visuals that we need and get you a list.
There you go.
Yeah, that would be real helpful. And then, but I think it would be very cool if we could run across any really old footage of any of the racing that was done around here. Pictures of the Quaker States, you know, stickers that they used to put on the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
They are in what the ladies were talking about there.
Good.
It's in that display. Them stickers are up there.
That sea of green that you were talking about, that would be neat.
Yeah.
The cars that were fuel injected that we talked about, we have a still photo of them three cars.
That'd be great.
Different
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, what I'll do is I can take still photo, scan it in, and I can literally move within that photo.
Okay.
Yeah, so it works really, really well. I can put a little bit of motor noise underneath it, so you guys will be talking about those three guys, and you'll see the image of the three cars, and I'll be zooming in on them. You'll hear the sounds of the motors. Now people are going to say, "Well, that's not what they sound like." Well, too bad. It's close.
Who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
If you go to the World Outlaw Show, you'll have it. You'll have the sounds like you won't believe.
That'll
be incredible.
Yeah, that's what I'd love to do. That.
And you're still a cute. Kendra's 20 years with Quaker State on that car. It's still on his car. It's just a big Q now, that's because they changed companies and they're not allowed. Well, you heard they're not allowed to use the Quaker State anymore. That they have to use the Q.
Oh, really?
So that's kind of a change. That's just come off. So any of the racing cars have Q on them now. Not Quaker State.
Q's their marketing.
It's not Pennsylvania Oil anymore.
That's
what's going on. Yeah.
Do you think that as much oil that they're trying to get back into, that they might be able to get back into using Pennsylvania oil?
They're using all the synthetics.
Yeah, that's
it's,
true.
It's
yeah.
almost.
Yeah.
Well, oil. The oil. Your oil based off of motor oil come literally from anywhere, and then they just put additives and change the chemistry and.
Yep.
It's really hurt us when they went to synthetic with racing motors. It's just you can't, you can break the motor in with synthetic, but you can't race it.
You can't really run with it.
No.
When they say synthetic, are they talking solely non-oil, something else?